Ми сьогодні хочемо вам представити професора коледжу Сент-Марія з Каліфорнії, США, професора Веттемера, який у нас сьогодні виступив із лекцією «Історія і філософія написання Тодору Лобертова». Лекція вже англійською мовою. Прошу привітати професора.
My Ukrainian is very limited, so I'll be speaking English. I hear some of you speak English, so this is good. How many people here have read or seen The Lord of the Rings? Ooh, wonderful, wonderful. So plenty of points of connection. If you haven't, I'll try to explain the important features of the book as I go. However, know ahead of time, spoilers are going to abound. Do you have this word, spoilers, in Ukraine? Wonderful. So, jumping right in, I want to start by telling you some of the things about the biography of J.R.R. Tolkien, which you might not know, particularly if you've only read the books or watched the movie. There's actually a film coming out about J.R.R. Tolkien's life, I think within the next year. So some of this information you might be able to get there, but so double spoiler alerts. Tolkien had a really sad childhood. He was, please, there's plenty of room in front, I don't sit. He had a very sad childhood. He was born in South Africa, and his father died when he was quite young, didn't have very many memories, and because of that, his mother had a hard time finding work. They were quite poor and had to move back to her hometown, Birmingham, England. He was raised kind of out in the countryside, fell in love with the woods and the forests, and then, tragically, his mother also died. He and his brother are then raised in Birmingham proper by a priest, Father Morgan. And being raised by this Roman Catholic priest was very formative for J.R.R. Tolkien. It ended up becoming sort of a primary way that he thought through his identity, which you'll see ends up coming out in a big way in The Lord of the Rings. He also studies at a high school there, a primary school, called St. Andrews, which is famous for producing sort of scholars who went on to Oxford and Cambridge and other things. While he's studying there with his close friends, falls in love with languages. He not only learns, as he had started learning Greek and Latin and French and German, but he also starts learning Anglo-Saxon, Old Norse, languages that aren't spoken anymore and weren't at that time considered particularly academic. You might know Greek is kind of a dead language. Like you study Greek if you're weird and you like Homer or Aristotle or Plato. But if you like Anglo-Saxon, you're even weirder. We don't seem to have very much important literature in Anglo-Saxon, right? You might have a similar phenomenon in Ukraine where there's an older version of Cyrillic that isn't really spoken anymore, and you might know someone who's interested in it, perhaps your professors, I don't know. But it's sort of an oddity. So he's an odd person from the beginning. He's in love with languages, and of course, as is always the case, if you love something, you end up finding other people who love that thing, right? And so he has a group of friends who are in love with these old languages, sort of the geeks, they'd hang out in the library together. And as they studied the languages, they became aware of something. They learned that while ancient Norse has the myths from before Christianity came to Norway and Iceland, and you might have read those, they're wonderful. And ancient Greece has their myths all written down, Homer, Hesiod, more and more. Other peoples, the Germanic peoples, have myths that are written down from before the Christian era, Spain, France, all these languages, Latin, have many myths, stories, that the people would tell one another. But England did not have that. And so there's an awareness by studying the language that they're missing out on something, which is that they don't have the stories that go with the language, not in any comprehensive form. Come, please.
There's still some more people who are squeezing somehow.
Seats in the back.
There are no chairs. I thought they were some strange tower.
I'm the strange tower.
Oh, you are.
My company. Yeah. So Tolkien becomes aware with his friends by studying the ancient language that there's no myth to go with the language, the way there is in these other countries and cultures. And so, they make a decision as a group of friends that what they really want to do, if they go off to Oxford, and they get into Oxford, Cambridge, etc., really nice schools, they want to be the people who write those myths for the English-speaking people. Now, right as they're getting ready to go off to college, World War I starts. And you might know that a lot of people die in World War I. J.R.R. Tolkien is sent to the front. He fights in World War I. And as he's fighting, they're writing letters to one another. All of his friends from school are on different parts of the war. And he's getting letters back to the foxholes. And the letters are saying, "We're so sorry your friend died. We're so sorry your other friend is dead. We're so sorry your best friend just died." One day he gets a letter from one of his closest friends who's still alive. And the letter, we actually have it, says, "They're telling us we're about to go and charge the German lines tonight. I might not make it. If I don't, I want you to remember that we need to write the epic. Go home and start the epic." This ends up being extremely powerful for him, because the next day he gets a letter that said he went up and over and he also died. Of all of Tolkien's friends from school, only one other friend besides himself survives World War I. And he goes home, he gets injured, gets sent back to a hospital. And in the hospital, he actually starts right there. And he starts writing what will become the Silmarillion. It has been translated into Ukrainian. You can go read it. It's the backstory for The Lord of the Rings. It's the mythic structure that explains what The Lord of the Rings is. I highly recommend, if you've read The Lord of the Rings, if you enjoyed it, you should read The Silmarillion to help sort of give you a deeper understanding of what's going on inside The Lord of the Rings. So he begins. He begins the epic. Each of these things is going to come up throughout his life. But now, we're going to talk about what he's doing in terms of philosophy. So I mentioned that J.R.R. Tolkien is a Roman Catholic. He was raised by a priest. And believes this is very formative. And when I say that someone's a Roman Catholic, people might have different associations. So I know that that means one thing here in Lviv, to be Roman Catholic. It means something completely different if you live in Italy. It means something completely different if you live in England. England is a Christian country in general, but they're Anglican. And Roman Catholics are sort of looked down on. They're excluded. They're the Irish. You know, the Irish are the poor people we don't want to be like. So he's a Roman Catholic, he goes to university, and he realizes that there's a whole way of thinking that the Roman Catholic Church has preserved, which was being lost in the Anglican Church, even though all Christians more or less share this. And it goes back to ancient Greek philosophy. Here's the first place where you'll see this. So when this is the one ring to rule them all. If you know anything about The Lord of the Rings, you've seen this. Even if you haven't watched The Lord of the Rings or read it, you've seen memes. You have memes, right? You're on the internet. So there's memes about the One Ring that I've seen that sometimes circle around. There's a question when he first publishes the book, where did you get the idea for this ring? The idea behind the ring is, if you put the ring on, you vanish. If you take the ring off, you're visible again. But it's also associated with power. It's made by this evil character, and it's got a significant portion of his own personal sort of power and magic invested in the ring itself. And so if you know how to use the power, it's not just that it makes you invisible, but it can make you immortal. It can allow you to control other people. It has all these powers associated with it. When he first comes out with the book, people ask, where did this come from? Did you get it from Wagner? This is the first assumption people have, because you might have heard Wagner has the Ring Cycle. It's a famous series of German operas. I got to watch it last summer, actually, like 19, 20 hours of opera. By the end, I'm just completely exhausted, and I want to invade Poland. And the ring, Tolkien says, does not come from Wagner. He's very insistent that this is not the case, that the ring is actually related to Plato's ring in the Republic. If you remember, he's a Roman Catholic. He's trying to think through what is this ancient Greek philosophy that Christianity has preserved, but we're sort of losing it in modernity. So in Plato's Republic, you have characters who are trying to argue about what is justice, and I'll be delivering another lecture, I believe, at this university in the economics department on Plato's Republic and the idea of justice. And at one point, Socrates is trying to defend the idea of justice, and there's another character, Glaucon, who says, "Socrates, you don't know what you're talking about. You haven't really dealt with the problem yet." Socrates says, "Tell me the problem." And he says, "I want you to think about the ring of Gyges." And the story of Gyges is, there's a shepherd, and an earthquake happens, and the ground opens up. And the shepherd walks down into the cavern that is open, and he sees a hollow horse. And if you're familiar with Greek mythology, hollow horses mean quite a lot. He looks in the hollow horse, and he sees a dead body. And on the dead body is a ring. The shepherd takes the ring. He leaves the cave, puts it on, and then he goes to meet with the king at the sort of monthly gathering where the king talks to his shepherds about how the flocks are doing. He walks into the room, and he realizes no one can see him when he has the ring on. So then, Glaucon says, what does he do? What would you do if you had a ring that could make you invisible? Well, here he is. He's this character right here, and this is the king of Lydia, and of course, the queen, looking quite attractive. And they can't see him, because he's got the ring on. So what does he do? He sleeps with the queen, he kills the king, he takes over the country. He satisfies his desires. Now, Glaucon says, let's be honest here. If you give this ring to somebody who's just, who's a good person, and you give this ring to somebody who's a bad person, what's the bad person going to do? Well, they're going to steal, maybe they'll kill their enemies, they'll get what they want, they'll go into their professor's books and change their grades to A's. If you give it to a good person, what are they going to do? Let's be honest, they'll do exactly the same thing. It's interesting, interesting. So Tolkien is borrowing this, I would say, pretty clearly from Plato's Republic, and imagining a one ring, like imagine that it's real, this one ring that's invisible, and you get this ring, the temptation would be overwhelming. And the temptation is always to do bad. If you wanted to do something good, why would you need a ring of invisibility? In fact, it would be better to do it with the ring off, and then people can say, wow, you're so good. Thank you for doing good. You put the ring on when you want to do things that you don't want people to see. And in some ways, this is the scenario we're all always in. The things we do when no one's looking are sort of the clearer revelations of what we are, of our character, than the things that we do when everyone's watching. Right now, with all of you watching me, right, I'm not going to try to do something wicked, because by watching me, you're judging. So I'm trying to do good things. But what happens when there's no one watching? What happens when I go back to my apartment? These are the questions we have to ask ourselves. And Tolkien is bringing this to the surface through The Lord of the Rings. He has a second parable from the Republic, which is the Allegory of the Cave, which you might have read. This one's more famous. So in the Allegory of the Cave, and this time Socrates is telling a story to Glaucon to try to explain why Glaucon's wrong. Socrates says, I want you to realize, Glaucon, that the situation we find ourselves in life is actually that we are like men bound by the neck against a wall. We can only look one direction. And on the wall that we're looking at, we can see shapes. We can see these shapes moving across the wall. And we like to shout out what we think the shapes are. I see a horse. And everybody claps. Oh, good job, you saw a horse. I see a jar. Oh, yeah, you saw a jar. Good job, good job. But of course, the shapes are just shadows for people who are walking on the other side of the wall, holding them up, and the fire is casting a shadow. So we're just trapped in this cave. Now, we can think of this metaphysically. We can think of this ethically. I want you to try to think of this parable just practically for a moment. So in a very practical way, you are actually bound to your senses. Come, come. In a very practical way, you're bound to your senses. So we have a tendency to think that we're really seeing things. I can feel the desk. I can see the desk. smell the desk. But our senses aren't giving us actual knowledge of what the desk is. And anyone who studied, you know, freshman physics knows this, right? What is the desk? There's atoms swirling, there's a strong and weak nuclear force. There's other things happening with the desk. But think of this relative to yourselves. So Socrates says, the real tragedy is that these people can't see themselves. They're stuck looking at a wall. They think the point of reality is to look at these shadows moving along. He says, we're just like that. We can't look at ourselves. You might see yourself in a mirror, but is that you? It's a reflection of you. You might see a picture of yourself, but is that you? It's a picture of you. You see people seeing you, but that's not you. Even if you somehow surgically kind of took your eyes out and pointed them back and looked up and down yourself, that's not really you. That's not what you look like. So it brings up this question of what are you? Now, he concludes the story. This story has a happy ending, so. Imagine what you really need to do, Socrates says, is break the chain on your neck and get out of the cave. When you get out of the cave, it'll be very painful. The light will blind your eyes for quite some time, but eventually you'll be able to see reality as it really is. You'll be able to go meet a real horse rather than just engaging with a shadow of a horse. When J.R.R. Tolkien tells you the story of how the ring came to exist with Gollum and then with Frodo, the two characters who sort of have the ring most essentially in The Lord of the Rings, he's dealing with both of these stories and he's combining them into one story. So Gollum is hiding in a cave and he's hiding there with a ring, and the ring can make him invisible and satisfy his desires. But what does Gollum want? Fish. Occasionally to hide from an orc. His desires are very small. He's become a pathetic little creature. Something you should pity. And when Frodo gets the ring, he goes down there and he gets the ring and he gets out. But of course, he's more like the shepherd Gyges, who went down and got the ring from the cave and came out, and it corrupts him. It makes him bad. It makes him want to kill the king and sleep with the queen. But of course, he's a hobbit, so his desires are also very small. So what do hobbits use the ring for? They use it to hide from relatives that come over that they don't want to see them. Slowly over time, though, possessing this ring corrupts him. So there's a whole system of philosophy that Christianity uses sort of Plato to think through what the Gospels are saying. And it's related to this, and it's related to The Lord of the Rings. Think about this ring that allows you to take your body and make it disappear. Christianity, by reading Plato, particularly St. Augustine and then also Thomas Aquinas and others, says that you have to think through what evil is. So what is evil? We tend to think of evil as perhaps cheating on a test or stealing cookies from your mother. You have cookies in Ukraine, right? Something else I need to use there. It's evil, we think, is a desire for something good that some other person doesn't want me to have. But if that's what evil is, it doesn't make a lot of sense that we shouldn't get whatever we want. But if you look at people who get exactly what they want, sometimes we see that that actually looks worse than having an authority that prevents us from getting what we want. Just think of people who suddenly win the lottery and they lose their minds. They lose their relationships. They lose their friends. So evil, Christianity says, is not like that at all. It's not like wanting the cookies from the cookie jar. Evil is non-existence. Evil is a desire for nothing. It's when you want something that shouldn't be. Tolkien is making this very explicit in his work. And once you see it, the whole book opens up to you. So the ring, right, is evil. And what does it do? It takes you away. It makes you not exist anymore. Think about the Nazgul. The Nazgul were once kings, glorious kings, good guys. They became evil. They became corrupted. They started serving evil. And what happens to them? They start to disappear. They start becoming invisible. So you only ever see the Nazgul. These are the sort of minions of the evil character wearing these cloaks because they have no body left. They're just an invisible thing wandering around doing bad. Or we can see the same thing with Sauron. So Sauron is the main evil character. And if you read the Silmarillion initially, he's quite beautiful. He's the most beautiful of the sort of gods, godlike characters, angelic beings. And as he participates in evil, he becomes first like a guy wearing a suit of armor. That's all he can be. He's ugly to look at, but at least he looks kind of big and powerful. And by the time we get to the Lord of the Rings, he's done so much evil that he can't even have that anymore. All he is a lidless eye of fire. He can look, but he can't be looked at. He's lost his being. He has no substance left. So in a way, non-being is always parasitic on being. For something to not exist, it has to have first existed. In the same way, we see things like goodness is parasitic on evil. Or evil is parasitic on goodness. Got that backwards. For something to be evil, it has to first have been good, and then it is corrupted into something evil. Evil can't exist substantially on its own. This is perhaps clearest with truth and lying. So think of it this way. Imagine you have somebody who tells the truth all the time, somebody who lies all the time. The liar can't understand why someone would tell the truth. But a truth teller can understand why someone would lie. The truth teller can know that sometimes it's actually quite disadvantageous. It's not good for me to tell the truth. But I tell the truth not for my own sake, but for its own sake. I don't tell the truth because it's going to do me the best thing. I tell the truth because it's good in and of itself. Whereas you lie because you want something. You lie because you want to hide. You want to not exist. So liars can't understand truth tellers, but truth tellers can understand liars. So the opposite of these characters who are sort of non-existence, they're disappearing. In the films, this is done quite well. When Frodo gets stabbed by the Nazgul blade and goes into him, the blade disappears. And then what starts happening to Frodo? He starts fading. He starts disappearing. They say in the book he becomes translucent. They start to be able to see the light of the stars through him. As he's sort of disappearing into evil, he's literally disappearing. But think about the opposite. Think about the good characters in The Lord of the Rings. So anyone in the Shire. The Shire is where the hobbits live, and it's always portrayed very joyfully. They're feasting. They're generally drinking at least a little too much. They're enjoying themselves. They're laughing. They're dancing. The Shire is an image of goodness, which is being, which is truth. This is how it's, in some ways, the Shire is like the town you want to be from, but you're not. Like when you think of the ways your town that you grew up in could be better, you know, the Shire is kind of what comes to mind, at least for me. The Shire maybe is an image of, like, the family that you wish you were from. Like, you know there's some problems with your parents, and so if you just imagine what would, like, a perfect little family be, you'd be, like, dancing outside under a tree with, you know, paper lanterns and having a beer with your dad. It's substantial goodness. We see the same thing with the elves even more so. So the elves have so much being, so much goodness, that the film does a good job of showing them what they're always sparkling, they're shimmering, like the vampires in that book that I didn't read. What is the book? I can never remember the title.
Twilight,
that's the book. So you have these vampires that shimmer. They're just doing it for, I don't know why they have the vampire shimmer, but Tolkien's doing it to show you that this is what existence looks like. You know, the elves exist so much that they shine. And their cities similarly are portrayed as these glorious places that are sort of at one with nature. It's the way we want our cities to look. In some ways, Lviv is sort of the most elvish city I've been to. So you should really stop and appreciate how beautiful your architecture is here. I've been appreciating it all week. The people who are hosting there, like, stop talking about the architecture. The last image is Aragorn. So Aragorn is the protagonist of the story. He's the guy who becomes the king at the end. Here he is marrying his elvish princess. And when you think about Aragorn, he's a good person who's trying to become, his whole story is Aragorn is trying to become the king that he already is. Goodness and his own being are tied up into one thing. And he fails if he is not good. He will not become the good king if he fails to be good and does become the king, which is a temptation for him to take the ring, make himself king, but be evil. In a way, that's not to become who Aragorn is supposed to be. So I always describe Aragorn, he's like the guy that I want my daughters to marry. Manly, good looking, and a good guy, right? So enough philosophy, we'll come back to some of it. We're going to think about Tolkien as an etymologist. So, oh, here's some transcendentals. So, I'll just say this very quickly. These, for Tolkien, are all one thing. They're one thing. And if you're really going to get out of the cave, if you're going to get rid of the ring, this is what you'll realize. These are all one thing. Non-being, ignorance, vice, darkness, evil, injustice. Oh, plenty of time. Okay, I'll tell you a little bit more about the philosophy, and then we'll move on. Think about darkness and evil. I was going to do non-being and evil, but we'll do darkness and evil. So, similarly to goodness can understand evil, evil can't understand goodness. Truth tellers can understand liars, liars can't understand truth tellers. Light is a source of knowledge, but darkness never is. Think about this even like evolutionarily. You can't have a place which is perfectly dark and an animal evolve to have an eye. It wouldn't make sense. Now, why wouldn't it make sense? Because the eye has a purpose, and the purpose is to see light. If there's no light, you can't develop the organ to understand light. So light, in some ways, is associated with being. Light can understand darkness. Darkness has no knowledge intrinsic to itself. But once you understand light, then darkness makes a lot of sense. Darkness makes sense. Okay, etymology. Enough philosophy. You're a philologist anyway. Let me tell you about Tolkien and etymology. So I'm actually really thrilled. This is a philology department, correct?
Yeah.
So most Western universities now, your professors know this, but you might not, don't have philology departments anymore. And Tolkien would say this is a tragic loss. I would agree with him. Because about, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago, the study of language and literature in the English-speaking world and much of Europe, Western Europe, became separated. So they became completely separate disciplines, to the point in the United States where you have linguistics majors, so you're just studying language, the sort of nuts and bolts, and then you have literature majors, who just kind of read stories, but you're not required to do both any longer. And so they're actually in completely separate departments often. Almost universally. So when I told my colleagues that I was going to Ukraine to lecture in philology departments, a few of them said, "What?" They didn't even know the word anymore. Tolkien was essential at Oxford in defending philology as the unity of linguistics and literature. Oxford was going to change the way that most of England had changed into not having philology departments, and he actually, as one of the heads of the department, said, "No, absolutely not. We have to maintain philology." And it's actually related to this story that he was working on while he did that. So they actually lasted, I don't know, 30 years, I think, longer than most English universities at maintaining philology as a united discipline.
He was on the old deal.
So what?
He was on the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yes, that's exactly right. Ooh, we have a Tolkien scholar. So his first publication actually is not The Lord of the Rings. It's the Oxford English Dictionary. He was one of the first people to work on the first edition. And you know, each person was given certain words. So if you want to see the first thing Tolkien ever published, find the first edition and find the word walrus. Because they said, "You, Tolkien, start at walrus and work forward from there."
We happen to have the first edition at the library. The whole set.
That's
a rare thing.
Yeah.
Few places can post on that.
Genuinely. It's actually the most, I say it's the most useful tool if you're going to study English, is the Oxford English Dictionary. So make use of it. So Tolkien is trying to figure out how do we anchor words? There's a major question you have to ask yourself if you're studying linguistics. There are scholars who say actually that myths are a disease of language. So people start having language and then they start telling stories. Tolkien ends up taking almost exactly the opposite view, that actually, in fact, language is a disease of mythology. Humans have a desire to tell stories, to talk to one another, to communicate, And that desire is intrinsically bound up with words. Words are the mechanisms through which we communicate. So stories and words end up coming up simultaneously. Now, the English language is changing rapidly, has been for well over 100 years. Tolkien's aware of this, and he knows that there's danger of losing touch with the English language as it has been historically spoken, even in England. So if you read The Lord of the Rings, it's actually quite archaic, even for the era that it's written in. So if you read Shakespeare, Shakespeare's archaic because that's how they spoke on some level, though they didn't speak in iambic pentameter. Whereas Tolkien's archaic because he's trying to acquaint you with the way older English literature sounds and feels. He's intentionally being archaic and difficult, almost challenging you to read him. And he's doing this with words as well. So, for example, he says, look, etymologically, English is related to Old Norse. In Old Norse, they have the word Jotun. In Old German, they have the word Etunas. In Old English, they have Enta or Etten. But then somehow we just start saying giant. He knows how, but he says, if we really want to maintain the English language, we need the word Ent to be able to tie ourselves back into the history of the English language. People need to know what Ents are. Ents are, in the story, this is Treebeard the Ent. They're just a little taller than I am, and they're sort of walking, talking trees. And this is Treebeard the Ent hosting a couple of hobbits. So he gives us a story that can acquaint us with the word Ent, which nobody used, you know, for a few hundred years before Tolkien. Nobody was saying Etta or Etten. And he gives us the word Ent again, and to the point where now, if you talk to English speakers, your odds are pretty good they'll know what an Ent is. Big walking, talking tree thing from The Lord of the Rings. He does this with other words. So in French, cul-de-sac literally means the bottom of a sack. They also mean dead end. But in French, at least, if you thought about it for 10 seconds, you could know, oh, end of the sack. But in English, we just say cul-de-sac. We mean dead end. Most English speakers have no idea where we got this from, and it's in modern French influence. And so Tolkien says, well, look, we don't need these French people teaching us how to talk. We have a perfectly good English word, bag end. So he's trying to re-give us, right, the bottom of a sack as bag end, something at the end of the street. And what's at the end of the street? Bag end. This is the name of the hobbit hole that Frodo and Bilbo live in. He does this with other things. So hole by tla would mean hole builder in Old English, but nobody talks this way. He gives us a fake etymology of it going from sort of ancient English to Rohan all the way through to the contemporary era, but it's all fictional. He makes up the history of a word that never existed so that we could have the word hobbit. In Old English, the word for spider would have been kop or lop. We actually have this word still if you've learned the word cobweb. So the web that the spider leaves up in the corner of your house that you don't want to dust because it's too high. The word cob there is spider in Old English, but no, we've forgotten this. So he says, we need to remember this. How do you get people to remember it? Give them a story. So he has hobbits using the word addercop to talk about spiders, and then he has this big spider who's one of the enemies, she-lob, to remind you of lob. Ultimately, the etymology, while really interesting, and he goes on and on, the word shire, and just word after word, is trying to connect you back to the English language. Ultimately, it's in the service of the myth itself. And you see this in some ways. So, for example, if you read the Old Norse sagas, they have these things called dwarves, right? Short-bearded men work in the mines. If you read Finnish mythology, if you read Icelandic mythology, if you read Germanic mythology, all of these myths have dwarves in them. But the little bits of English myth that we have don't have the word dwarves in them. But we have the word dwarves in English. So he says, where did that come from? So he gives us dwarves. The characters of dwarves are there to anchor our modern word for dwarves back in a story so that we can return to it and know what we're talking about. So the point of the etymology is to remind us that we have a myth. There is a myth, the English myth. We've just lost it. In a lot of ways, this is actually quite similar to your situation here in Ukraine. I don't know a lot about Ukrainian history, but I read a couple of books getting ready to come here and lecture. So in, I think 980 it was that Vladimir the Great converts to Christianity and the country converts to Christianity and is baptized. Now, you had myths in Ukraine, and you have scholars currently who are trying to go back and figure out what those myths were like. but no one had written them down before they became Christians. So you don't really have the myths in their raw form the way that the Greeks do and the way that the Germans do and the Norse. So somebody needs to be the J.R.R. Tolkien of Ukraine if you want to sort of have that myth. Tolkien, remember, knew that there was no myth for England. They were in the same situation that you were. When the country became Christian, nobody had written it down. Right? They were all farming too hard. So he wants to be the one that writes the myth. So he says, okay, what would a myth be like? Well, we have to take the bits that we know of English mythology, even though they're post-Christian, and we have to work backwards from there. So for example, we have Beowulf, the hero. Sort of a Norse type hero. He dies at the end. It's always a good Norwegian way to end. He battles giants, and then at the end he battles a dragon. So Tolkien says, what would this have been like in old England, in the ancient English myth? Well, we need to have dragons. We need to have dragons. And so what do you see in J.R.R. Tolkien? Smaug the Destroyer. And who's battling him? These ridiculous little hobbits. We have other myths. So we have Arthur and the Round Table, the good king. And we see this, of course, with Aragorn, right? You need the king to return if you want peace in the land. The king has to be there to help sort of care and guide and be a good king. Yep, but the good king also has particular things that happen in England. Where does he get Excalibur? From the stone. So we need to figure out, why do we have this myth particular in England? Right? Not every culture has a sword and a stone that the king gets a sword from. So I think he puts this back in the story. Aragorn, one of the major features of his character arc, has Isildur's Bane, right? The sword that was broken. And over the course of the story, he has to reforge the sword before he can become the good king. But it's not just there. We earlier have seen Frodo, who has the sword Sting. He gets it from his uncle, Bilbo, who had once carried the ring. And when he passes the sword on, you know, if you asked me for a sword and I had a sword, I'd just hand you a sword. That's the normal way you get rid of a sword, right? But in the story, something interesting happens. Bilbo takes the sword and he buries it, says, as hard as he can, into a pillar. And he says, take it. It's yours. And you see Frodo grabbing the sword and pulling it out. So you have this myth of drawing the sword from a place where you shouldn't be able to get it. And then being a hero. So he's burying those myths in there, but then, of course, he's just reconstructing all these other myths from nothing but the language itself. Why is he doing this? Well, similar to the story of Ukraine, Augustine of Canterbury, in the year 597, goes to Kent and he preaches to King Ethelbert. And this doesn't happen in every country, right? In many countries, Christian missionaries go there and they just kill them, and Christian missionaries go there and they kill them, and they just keep doing that for a while. Maybe a few people convert, it's not a big deal. In Ukraine, right, you have somebody come and preach to the king, suddenly everybody converts, the whole country. That's what happened in England when Augustine of Canterbury came. Now, Tolkien says, that tells us that there must have been something in the culture, the stories that he's drawing from, that when King Ethelbert heard the story of the gospel, he said, wow, that reminds me a lot of this other story that I have. And Tolkien says that this story, The Lord of the Rings, is the myth of the English-speaking peoples. Now, when he starts the story, people think he's crazy. Fantasy literature doesn't exist as a genre. Nobody has done anything like this. I don't know if you've noticed, but epic poetry has kind of gone out of style. And yet, he does it anyway. And now, just recently, you have the Sunday Times saying the English-speaking world is divided into those who have read The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, and those who are still going to read them. I think it's safe to say that J.R.R. Tolkien has succeeded beyond his wildest imaginations. And The Lord of the Rings is, if not the most important work in English literature. There's a scholar, Germaine Greer, who hates J.R.R. Tolkien. And she says, my worst nightmare is that someday we will think that The Lord of the Rings is the most important book written in the English language. And she's afraid that she might be realizing that those dreams are coming true. Thank you. I have, I don't know, 30 minutes or so. What questions, comments, thoughts? will raise their hand to first. Oh, yes, please.
Which word was Tolkien working on as a etymological beginning?
Oh, yes. So go look up walrus. It's the big blubbery sea mammal with tusks. That was his first sort of published piece of writing after he gets back from the war and he's desperate for money. He gets married. And of course, as anyone who newly gets married, they're desperate for money. And so he takes a job writing the dictionary. Might sound boring for you, but for a language geek, writing the dictionary is pretty fun. So he really enjoyed it. Thank you. Good question. Others?
Probably. Could you tell us a bit more about Beren and Lúthien?
Oh, yes.
It's that is, you know, this kind of love, and she gave up her immortality to be able to be with a mortal man. That's mm-hmm. kind of love. Mm-hmm. You should, you know, had to. You should be like. Yeah.
You're fishing for a date, it sounds like.
No.
I'm teasing. So, yeah, Beren and Lúthien are a story from the Silmarillion. You sound like you've really read Tolkien.
You know, I can recite this poem.
Can you do it?
The grass
right
was green, the hemlock umbrellas tall and fair, and in the glade the light was seen, the stars of heaven shimmering. Tinuviel was dancing there, to music of a pipe unseen, the light of stars was in her hair, and in her raiment shimmering. The Beren came from mountains cold, and lost he wandered under leaves, and where the Elven river rolled, he walked alone and sorrowing. He peered between the hemlock sheaves, and saw in wonder flowers of gold upon her mantle and her sheaves, and in her raiment glimmering.
There's actually a lot more for that, but yeah.
Not fishing for a date. He needs a date. He's gonna get one. So all of you, take note. So Beren and Lúthien are actually like the prototypical characters in The Lord of the Rings. They're from the Silmarillion, but they then appear in The Lord of the Rings as part of the backstory. You might know that Aragorn and the Elven Queen that he's going to marry are both descendants of Beren and Lúthien, and so they're retelling the same story again, right? You have the human and the elf princess, and the princess has to give up immortality if she's going to end up marrying Beren. what you might not know, I don't know, you might not, is that, do you know that on J.R.R. Tolkien's grave, he's buried with his wife in Oxford. I've seen it. And it says, J.R.R. Tolkien, Beren, Edith Tolkien, Lúthien.
Oh.
When he writes the story of Beren and Lúthien, he thinks he's writing the story of his own relationship with his wife. It was one of the first stories that he actually ever wrote in the Silmarillion. It's one of the oldest pieces of his writing, is exactly what you recited right there. And so this concept that there's a marriage that's a union that's at the center of everything is deeply embedded in his work, as well as in his life, as well as Christians would say in reality. So he's drawing this from Ephesians in the Christian scriptures. And in Ephesians, you have St. Paul writing that in the end of all of reality, you know, the way you answer the question of how will reality end tells you lots about yourself. It says one thing about you if you think that at the end of reality, everything is just going to sort of disappear and decay and the sun's going to explode and we're all going to die. The end. Very tragic, very tragic, right? Kind of similar to the Norse. What do the Norse say is going to happen? Ragnarok. Big battle. The gods are going to come down and fight for goodness and truth and justice. And they're going to lose. Happy ending. Christians say, actually, at the end of reality is going to be like a marriage. God is going to come down like a bridegroom, like a groom. And he is going to marry humanity like his bride. The symbol of a marriage is, that's why it's a sacrament in the church. Many churches consider it a sacrament. And J.R.R. Tolkien certainly would have as a Roman Catholic. And so he understood his marriage to be a part of this archetypal marriage. I'll tell you a story about his marriage. So I told you that he had a very tragic childhood, right? And his mother and father had died. So he's being raised by a priest upstairs in Birmingham. Downstairs, being raised by a nun, is another orphan, his later wife. They fall in love because she's teaching him piano. And there's funny stories. They used to go around to the coffee shops and tea shops, and probably tea shops because it's England, in Birmingham. And they would always get a seat on the balcony, and they would take sugar cubes and try to get them in the hats of people, men who walked by, see who could get it in the hats. They'd get in trouble. The priest found out about the fact that they were dating. And what do priests do? He says, no, cut it up. You're too young. He's 15, 16 at the time. And he says, you can't talk to her until you're 21. In fact, you can't talk to any girls until you're 21. Oh, heartbreaking, right? Heartbreaking? Can't talk to girls until you're 21? Are you 21 yet?
20.
20, he's got a whole year. The priest talks to the nun, and the nun says the same thing. The nun actually takes it a step further and says, not only can you not talk, you can't live here. The nun sends her away to another town to be raised by a different person. Tolkien waits and waits until he's almost done with college. At 21, he sits down. He's done, almost done with his studies. He's about to finish, and he writes a letter. Edith, I love you. Marry me. Crazy letter, right? He gets a letter back. I'm so sorry. I'm already engaged. So a normal man at this point says, ah, cut my losses, find another girl, right? But Tolkien's completely insane. He gets on a train, buys a train ticket, goes to where she lives, and goes to her house and says, don't marry this other guy. He's a loser. Marry me. And she looks at him and she does exactly that. And so then, just a few weeks later, they go on a picnic, and she's dancing by the side of a lake. And that's what the poem is about. It's about her dancing for him. And he writes the poem, Baron and Lothian. Oh, that gets me every time. Gets me every time. Great question. Thank you. Thank you. Others? It doesn't have to be. You don't have to be able to recite a poem from there to be able to ask a question here.
Yes. May?
Yes.
No,
that's fine, yeah.
That's about it. You know, if you read the mythology, not only the Lord of the Rings, there's prophecy has a great role in it, mm-hmm. I suppose. Not everybody, but a lot of people know, especially the elder ones, the Eldar, mm-hmm. Eldari, they know about what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand that. How can you explain it?
Yeah, so he's drawing on the Judeo-Christian tradition of prophecy. So in ancient Israel, in the Jewish scriptures, for example, you would have a character who's a prophet. And what is a prophet? A prophet is someone who tells the truth to the people. So there's a little bit more to it than that, but that's a rough estimate. That's good enough for the moment. The prophet is somebody who tells the truth, and truth is truth no matter who you talk to, right? How many sides does a triangle have? Three. Some truths we're not likely to forget, like what's 1 + 1? 2. Some truths we are likely to forget. Do I have to be good? Easy to forget that one. Because of course, once you become a liar, it's hard to understand why you should tell the truth anymore, right? So the prophecies in The Lord of the Rings tend to work in this manner. That Gandalf, for example, is the prime example of a prophet. And Gandalf goes into town, and he says the truth to people, which is then why they hate him, right? So when he goes to Rohan, and he tells the truth to the people of Rohan, hey, you've become cowards, you've become lazy, it's sort of obvious to anyone who looks at you. You've become vicious, you're cheating, stop it. What do you do if somebody comes to your house and says this? You say, oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, here, have dinner with me, please. That was so nice of you. No, you get really angry. You throw them out. And so prophecy is working similar to that in most cases. There's a few exceptions, but in most cases this is kind of similar to what you're seeing there. The role of the prophet is the person who brings reality really close to your face. And you have to look at reality again. Yeah, thank you. Other questions? Be brave.
you know, and these two brothers, you know, Farmer and Boromir, they kind of can also want good and evil, because if you remember, the Boromir, he wanted to steal the ring of power, and the Faramir is opposite of him. Mm-hmm. He caught him in the Ithilien. Let him go. And he let them go. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So literary parallelism happens in most good literature. Boromir and Faramir are sort of telling one another's stories in a different way. And good stories work this way all the time, right? So a good story just uses literary parallelism. A great story tries to say, well, we want to tell this character's story again, but we want to tell it the way it should have been. And ultimately, they'll do that not once, but over and over again. So Faramir, there's a question about whether Boromir ultimately kind of repents at the very last second. But Faramir is telling Boromir's story better. Faramir is also telling Denethor's story a little bit better, his father. Gandalf, it actually says explicitly, is Saruman. Saruman is the evil wizard who gets it wrong. Gandalf dies and comes back again and gets to be Saruman as he should have been. Right? He makes the right choice where Saruman made the wrong choice. Gollum was once a hobbit who got the ring as his birthday present. Bilbo finds the ring on his birthday and then gives the ring to his nephew on his nephew's birthday. So Frodo is telling Bilbo's story, is telling Gollum's story as it should have been. In the end, everyone should have destroyed the ring. In the end, Frodo tries to get it right. Aragorn is Isildur as he should have been. Galadriel is Shelob as she should have been. That one's a little more controversial. And I think that part of why Tolkien is doing this is that he wants to help you realize that you have the exact same choices in front of you that all of these characters have. You can live your life not as you are, but as you should have been. That's a possibility for you. You don't have to be trapped in the cave. You don't have to be taking the ring and trying to live just for your own sake. You can choose to live to be good. You can live for the truth. You can try to be truly beautiful, not just beautiful on the outside, but on the inside as well. He's dealing with all this stuff at a really finely tuned level. And when you look closely, this stuff just pops out at you. That's great. Great questions. Other questions?
The last one for me.
The last one, okay. Truly. And be thinking of questions while you ask it.
You know, there is a concept of big man and little man. Mm-hmm. Small man, like Edain and the Easterlings. Mm-hmm. You know, how... Because great men live longer. They're tall, they're strong. And Easterlings, they are like short, wide, and stupid. And live...
So part of what's going on there is this idea that if you're sort of the good, the true, the beautiful, all these things are one. Evil and sin is corrupting. Right, so Gollum is like a hobbit that's been evil for a long time, and he gets kind of short and shrunken and small. And he's just trying to make these things visible. I don't know, I mean, some scholars want to make a really big deal about that and say, oh, he thinks that sort of beautiful people are virtuous. And I think we would say, no, I think he says that true beauty is virtue. It's easy to fool people that you're virtuous. But of course, that's vice. That's badness. It's easy to pretend to be good. It's easy to appear beautiful. It's hard to be beautiful. And that's part of the distinction he's trying to get to. Why do I think that we can say that he's not sort of making a broad racist argument? Because who's the ultimate hero? It's the smallest, goofiest, most pathetic people. The hobbits. You have three hobbit idiots bumbling into Mordor. And again, the whole point there is that evil kind of brings about its own destruction. It's the blindness of Sauron, ironically, that ends up destroying him. It's not that the hobbits are so powerful, so good-looking, so pure. It's that they're so stable. They're not willing to be corrupted as much as other people. Great questions. Thank you. Other thoughts? Questions? Yes.
I want to ask about Tolkien's conception of the good and the evil. Does he think about the good as about a substance, a kind of substance, and does the evil look, in his opinion, looks like nothing, just nothing?
Yes, these are great questions. So
this is like that example that you told us about when there is a ring and anyone who puts it in becomes invisible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are philosophies that say that there is evil substance in reality. Some stuff is evil. Maybe you haven't worked with this on a philosophical level, but you probably know people who say something like, money is evil. Money corrupts. The more money you have, the more evil you are. Something like this. So if you read Genesis 1, so the oldest book of the Bible, arguably, the first book of any Bible, God creates the light. And what does he say? It's good. He says the light is good. God creates mountains. What does he say? That's good too. He creates a river. That's good. He creates a tree. That's good. At the end, he creates a man. He says that's good. And he creates a woman. He says that's very good. So if you read that, and then you say, okay, God created everything. That's what it says. If you believe it. If God creates everything, and then he says that everything he creates is good, then you have to ask the question of what is evil. So to Jews, and then to Christians, substance itself is good. There's no evil substance. If evil exists in any way, it's always a corruption or a perversion of substance. Evil can't intrinsically be creative. Good can be creative. God creates. The devil, evil things, can never create. They can't make new things. They try, but they fail. And so you see this most clearly, this guy knows, but the elves themselves are the sort of best things. They're so beautiful, right? They're shiny. The orcs are kind of the opposite. Well, how did you get orcs if everything is good? Well, orcs are actually elves, which many years ago, thousands of years ago, have been tortured by the Sauron Morgoth character. They've been tortured and bred to become these corrupt, disgusting beings. It's a corruption of a good thing. You have the same thing all over the place. So sort of ents and trolls. Some people say that the trolls that you see, the really ugly, bigger than orc beings, are the ents, these beautiful trees that have been tortured by Sauron or Morgoth into becoming trolls. So evil is always a corruption of the good, never the opposite. And it goes back to that Hebrew scripture. Substance itself is good. And actually, can I do etymology for a second? That etymology, the history of words. So in English, in the Jewish language, Hebrew, the word for substance and glory are quite close. So goodness, glorious things are heavy. In English, we have this still. So if I say to my friend, he's a really heavy guy, I'm not calling him fat. What you mean when you say he's a really heavy guy is that they have a lot of presence. They're big ideas. They're big-hearted. You say, wow, that's a person of substance. You're not saying there's a lot of stuff there in that person. They ate a lot this morning, right? You're saying they have character. They're a good person. Yeah. If you say, I heard a speaker today, and he said weighty things. His words had weight. It meant he spoke some truth. There's something good in what he said. It doesn't mean my words themselves are really, they dragged me down. It means that they had substance. So even in the English language, he's trying to help us remember that we have this theory that existence and goodness, one thing, they're one thing. Great question. Thank you. Thank you. Any others? We have 5 more minutes? 10 more minutes? Yeah? Okay? No? Yeah? Yeah. Okay, yeah. 10 more minutes. 5. 2 questions. Yeah.
Why don't you choose an object as a ring?
Went out a nose ring or a, yeah. So why, the question is why does Tolkien use a ring? I think there's a few reasons. So the Ring of Gyges from Plato's Republic is the primary one. But there are several characters who comment on the ring. And they say things like, what a small thing it is that carries the weight of the world. So there's this sense that the most important thing might be actually something quite small. It's the thing we might overlook. There are other people who say things like, if you remember Sauron is this glowing eye. And I will get to it. There we go. So Sauron, perfect, is a glowing eye. And so there's something there that's also, it's circular, it's hollow. A ring itself, while it has some substance to it, right, the ring, there's nothing in the middle. You can see right through it. So it's perhaps a symbol of non-existence, again, in a way that, I don't know, a cloak of armor wouldn't feel like an image of non-existence in the way that a circle could possibly look. Does that make sense? But ultimately, he's getting it from Plato. Yeah. Thank you. Question.
May I?
Yes, please.
So my question is, to your mind, what was Tolkien's original purpose when he wrote The Lord of Rings? Mm-hmm. Why? Like, why did he create the
Yeah. So the question is, what was the original purpose when Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings? I do think he was thinking through the myth for England, but also I think it was a labor of love. You know, he just kind of had these stories in his head and he wanted to write them down. So he wrote The Hobbit first, and then he wanted to write a sequel to The Hobbit. So he starts working on The Lord of the Rings. And even The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion, he would not have written them if it weren't for his good friend, C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis is famous for the Chronicles of Narnia stories, which you may have read. So Tolkien was sort of this weird guy interested in languages and these old stories. And when he showed the story he wrote, just the beginnings of it, the Silmarillion, the Lay of Beren and Lúthien, Lewis, very extrovert guy, sort of grabbed and said, you have to keep writing. You have to keep writing. So he says he would not have written it if it weren't for the encouragement of his friend. So that was at least a major motivation, was just to keep his friend happy. His friend wanted to read more, you know, so he kept writing for his friend. Thank you. Great question. Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here in Lviv. There's other events which will be happening throughout the week. If you want, you can come up and talk to me afterwards. Happy to take a selfie with you. Take care. Enjoy your day.
So maybe may I just voice your wholehearted thank you also, the gratefulness of the gratitude of the department and this whole medium, so to speak, for bringing this topic to the attention of the younger part of our community. This is a fantastic topic, and it has been great to have a chance to listen to you and to have you here. And we look forward to your talk tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.